Hello, folks. Another week, another episode of Soundtrackin'. Thank you so much to everybody who has been listening, who subscribed. It's really lovely to have your support and your ears as well to share some brilliant stories and music with you. Just to point out as well, I always tell you this at the end of the podcast, but I thought I may as well tell you at the start this week. Obviously, we're slightly restricted in terms of how much music we can play on the podcast, but what we do is for every show, once you've listened to the podcast, if you do want to go and listen to all the music in its entirety that we've talked about and featured in the podcast episode, you can do so. So there's a playlist for every episode of the podcast up on our Spotify playlist. So please do go and check that out. I should also say massive thank you as well. I've had a ridiculous amount of response to last week's episode. Equally for Rada Blank, and who a lot of you have found a huge inspiration. Isn't she amazing? I actually stuck up one of our little YouTube shows with her, just her, last week. So if you want to go and watch her and see her enthusiasm as well as hearing it on last week's episode, then please do so. Just look up Soundtrackin' on YouTube. And also Ben Frost, who talked in depth about his work on the Dark score. What was lovely is there's quite a few people got in touch and said he doesn't normally do much. So it was so great to hear him talk about his process and how he works and how he put together that incredible score over those three seasons of Dark. So thank you very much for your lovely comments. And also just to remind you that the Dark score is available on Invader Records. Should you be a big fan of Ben's and you want to go and maybe buy someone or yourself a Christmas present, just pointing that out. It's all about girl power on this week's episode of Soundtrack, and with not one but two women at the very top of their game. First up is Sofia Coppola returning to the podcast to discuss her new film On the Rocks, which she both wrote and directed, starring Rashida Jones and Bill Murray. It tells the story of Laura, a mum having doubts about her marriage, whose charming yet cynical father, Felix, played by Murray, suggests her husband may be having an affair. Now, it's streaming on Apple TV now and sees both leads on fine form. I really enjoyed this film. I loved seeing Bill Murray back under the kind of watchful and encouraging eye of Sophia, and him and Rashida Jones have just the most brilliant chemistry together, particularly in the scenes where they're having dinner or drinks. So I highly recommend you go and check out On the Rocks, as I said, on Apple TV now. Then I'm joined by Alison Brie, best known for her roles in Mad Men, Community and Glow. All great shows. But Alison's now directed an episode of Marvel 616. Now, Marvel 616 is a series of 8 documentaries about everyday folk who are in some way connected to the universe of the comics. Well, I'll let her explain further in a bit, but you can find out what it's all about for yourselves on Disney+. Before that, Sophia, who has, as usual, assembled a wonderful collection of songs for her movie. Among them, I Fall in Love Too Easily by Chet Baker.
I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love too terribly hard for love to ever last. My heart should be well schooled, 'cause I've been fooled in the past, but still I fall in love so easily. I fall in love too fast.
Hey, hi. Sophia.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good. Nice to see you again.
Yeah, thank you so much for the other week for doing our kind of crazy extended film chat show. It was so brilliant.
Oh no, it was fun talking to you about those movies.
So nice to enthuse about film. you know, in so many different films as well. So it was great.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Thank you for doing this. It was so great. I was listening back to the last time you came on the podcast when you were releasing The Beguiled, episode 43 on our podcast, and we're now 220 in, which is great. But it's I was so excited to have you back because congratulations on the Rocks. I love this film. I felt so at home with it, and it made me laugh. That was one of the main things, actually, that I can't remember laughing along with a film so much for such a long time.
Oh, I'm so glad.
That was because of a lot of different things. I mean, Bill Murray, hands down, you know, kind of, he could just sit and look at a camera and not do anything and I would probably laugh. But I just think that you've tapped into something that I feel like I haven't seen represented so honestly. Being a mum, being a working mum, and kind of trying to find your groove, being in a funk, all that stuff that this film kind of throws up. And I think because, you know, you've written this as well, and it just feels like such a brilliant discussion, I guess, for people to have with this film in terms of, you know, this character and where she is and what she's going through. But it's done with such light relief along the way as well.
I'm so glad, because I was trying to put in the things that I was thinking about when I was starting to think about this idea, and my kids were younger, and just sort of this weird transition into school life and all these people that were to the whole new universe, and how weird it was, and that moment of trying to find your footing, and then combining it with being in the mood to try to make more of a sophisticated comedy, because I was missing those kind of movies and have something fun. And I feel like our reality has been so heavy, and also I feel like a lot of the stuff on TV, there's like this real everything, a lot of things are gritty and violent and pushing things, and I didn't want to do anything challenging. But so it had to be something really sweet and sincere, but without being totally sappy, or that was the kind of the scary challenge. And I'm glad, and of course I always love seeing Bill and dressing him up, and it feels like, especially right now, we all need a little Bill Murray.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, Bill Murray cheers us all up. But was it easy to write?
No, not at all. I mean, I always find writing the hardest part, but especially an original screenplay. And I look back, and this is my third one. It takes me 10 years in between to have enough life accumulated to have something to write about. And I always feel like it's, you know, reflecting a different stage of transition. And where adapting is more like a fun puzzle to try to figure out, but it's not as scary and lonely, and because you have to, you know, just kind of be alone with yourself to come up with it and not rely on another writer. But yeah, it was really hard. So I started thinking about it. I just looked at my notes like 7 years ago, and I was,
whoa,
I know, I was working on other projects, and I had other versions of it which were terrible, and I was really stuck. And talking to my brother, who was always really helpful, he helped me a lot talking about it with him, and Mitch Glazer, one of our producers who is close with Bill, he was really encouraging that it could be a great role for Bill. And so at first I didn't think I would work with Bill again, because I was afraid of letting anyone down, because we that character is so beloved. And then, you know, Mitch encouraged me, and I started picturing him, though it has to be Bill, and I just have to and it's fun to see him at a, you know, different moment, and that helped in the writing.
I have that thing sometimes with when I go to a concert and I see one of my favorite bands, and I kind of go, I don't know if I ever want to see them live again, because that was perfect, and how, you know, it's kind of,
you want to remember them.
Yeah. And so hearing you say that about Bill, that feels like a kind of similar thing. But there's just something magical, I think, about how you write for him that comes off the screen. He feels so, it gives him a spark that we don't see with him. I mean, we see so, you know, Bill Murray has a spark, whatever he does. But I think in the way that you write him, there's something that he relishes in that performance as well.
Thank you. I appreciate his tender side. And I do like dressing him up and making him kind of more debonair. Yeah, he has that side, but I think he has fun with it. And it's always surprising when he goes into an emotional scene, or he has to be. The scene in Mexico when he's talking about a past love, losing her, I was really touched, and I said, you were really talking about someone, and he said, yeah, like, you know, but I just think he really puts his his heart. He's such a deep person and he puts himself in it. And I feel lucky that he trusts me enough to really put his full heart into it. And Rashida, he had so much regard for her too. I think that really helped because he really trusted her and he admires her. And so they had this real, you know, teamwork.
They're so good together on screen. Even just when the way that she physically reacts to some of the stuff that he says, you know, just the kind of the eyebrow raise or the very subtle things, but it's so like a game of table tennis almost. It's so great to watch.
Oh, I'm so glad. She's so good at that. I think also she's so smart that she can convey a lot just with the look. And a lot on the script, a lot of it would just say, you know, she gives him a look because like there's nothing you can say to someone who's blind.
Yeah.
But I feel like she conveys so much. Yeah. And just with an eyebrow. Yeah. And she had to be the straight man, you know, next to his more flamboyant side and kind of keep it grounded.
Was the musical number in the script in Mexico?
Yeah. I always like to put a scene with Bill singing because I love him. As a kid, I remember him from SNL being the lounge singer character. So I just think of him as a crooner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Gosh, you're a wonderful audience. Say, where are you from?
Chicago.
How many people in Las Vegas tonight are from Chicago? Can we hear from you? God bless you. I really dig Chicago. One of my favorite towns. Really like it out there. See, I have some relatives in Chicago. I really should be looking them up. Well, if you're from Chicago, there's a very real chance you'll be singing this song tomorrow. Those raindrops keep falling on my hair. Thank you. That doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. Crying's not for me, because I'm never going to stop the rain by complaining. Because I'm free, nothing's worrying.
And I thought he was the kind of character who, you know, walks in and sings. My dad sings a lot. Yes. And so that was a little homage. But he wouldn't go into a hotel and take over like that. But just with me. He breaks into song, which my friends always are entertained by, not on a stage like that. But so it was fun to ask Bill. I thought he'd be, yeah, that character would be the kind of guy that would have taken over the whole room before she gets there. And I imagine like in college, he, you know, sang at a piano bar or something. but he has to make a big entrance, as she says. And when we did that song, I asked Paul Schaefer to help produce the song. And I didn't hear it before we were filming. And so Bill kept it under wraps. And so the first time we heard it was with me and Rashida when we filmed it. And Bill was really singing it like for us for the first time.
Whoa.
And it was fun because he was proud to unleash his song. And it was like a fun surprise.
I almost feel like Bill, he almost, sometimes you think he exists within a musical almost in a way, because sometimes his movements and his rhythm is so musical anyway that he almost kind of sings, speaks sometimes, you know, he's kind of got that kind of delivery sometimes that I think there's just something wonderfully musical about him and his performance.
He's a dancer, yeah, as a person. He's a dancer.
Is he?
Yeah, he likes to dance and he's just, and you know, and you can tell he loves music, but he's just so full of life. I think that comes through that.
Yeah.
And I wanted that character to have that too, that he doesn't just smell the flowers, he embraces them with his whole being. Like that's his, but Bill does have that, which I feel like he, when he sees someone being uptight, he always tries to get them to loosen up, which I wanted him to do with that character, but I've seen him do it in life. He probably does it with me too.
I loved watching him with the kids as well. I thought that was a beautiful, you know, in terms of really captured that grandparent grandchild relationship, because it's wonderful watching my mom and dad with my kids in that it's a very different relationship, because you know they kind of just have the fun part almost.
Yeah, they have like a mischievous connection because they can sneak around and do things. They have a camaraderie that's really sweet. It's true. Yeah, that's sweet to see that with your family. And it was so cute to see him with the kids.
Was it fun to capture New York as well, you know, in terms of how you wanted to portray the character of New York as part of the film in a way as well. You know, New York's been captured, obviously, you know, on film, you know, so many beautifully and brilliant times over the years sort of thing. So it's, but it felt like it, we were kind of really taken into a neighborhood and a kind of.
Yeah, that was a challenge for me and talking to the cinematographer, Philippe Lesore, like, how are we going to shoot New York and make it feel like our own way and not just a version of something that we've seen, because there's so many iconic New York movies and to have the romance of New York and what we love about it. And so, yeah, I'm happy that when I saw it finished, it felt like, you know, our New York, and it definitely pays homage to classic New York movies that we know from the past, but also hopefully it feels like its own version of it. And I wanted to show the contrast of Rashida's character's world downtown and kind of the busyness and the sound of construction and the hecticness. And then she gets whisked away in Felix's car and they're off to 21 to the Bemelmans and these these classic old places that he sort of comes from, that era that is sort of fading era with all that history and kind of gentleman atmosphere. And so, yeah, so I tried to kind of capture what it feels like to be here with some reality, but then also with some film romanticism.
Yeah. You know, when he takes her into all these places to kind of almost wine and dine her, and it does feel like kind of almost watching a sort of 50s movie. It has got that kind of, like you say, romanticism about it. And just wanted to ask, when you're preparing to shoot your movies, do you watch films that are as reference points to help find a mood, or do you completely stay away from any kind of inspiration in a way?
I listen to music and I look at photos usually as a starting point. And then I have films in mind, but I don't always revisit them as much. I'm more kind of like, in the back of my mind, I had like Blake Edwards 10 for when they go to Mexico, but I didn't rewatch it because I kind of like it just as like a kind of dreamy state in the back of my mind. And I was thinking about Tootsie when they go to the Russian tea room and those kind of places. I think I watched that just to see like the people walking around New York and that energy and those kind of movies that thinking about 80s New York when it felt glamorous. But you should try not to look too directly at movies and more photos and music and stuff.
Yeah. What about music with this film? Because when we talked, it was so lovely actually listening back to our previous conversation and hearing you talk about in detail about, you know, things like Virgin Suicides and the mix of the air score, but also those needle drops and the purpose of those being, you know, very different and what they provided. But was this an easy film to try and work out the sonic side of it? Because there's not many needle drops in it.
It was, I was playing Chet Baker when I was writing it and kind of being in Felix's mode. And then my husband Toman, his band Phoenix, helped me with her music that I wanted her to feel she was in a separate world, but it had to contrast it, but not clash with Felix's world. And I didn't want to be too retro, but we are looking back at this kind of other music. And they suggested Michael Nyman, the score of her, like the intensity of her life to kind of set that pace, which I'm so relieved that he gave us permission, because we edited to that and there was like, there's nothing else like it. Phoenix guys has suggested that for that kind of hectic pace, which I think it puts you in her state of mind, kind of the grind of that. And I was also thinking about all that jazz. Sarah Flack, my editor, and I always think about that, like it's showtime in the morning and the routine and we did it at Marie Antoinette and we did it here, like just like every day is that getting the kids out the door, like that hectic moment that we know.
I love that film. Oh, it's so good. It's a
great movie.
That opening kind of sequence is just, it's one of the best opening sequences to a film ever.
It's so good. I love that movie. It's, I know that this is the best style and energy.
Yeah.
Another great New York movie.
Yeah, totally. With films, do you remember growing up in the world that you grew up in, but as a film fan, was there moments that you really remember the power of music within film resonating with you and kind of you having a fully grasping the extent of how important it can be and how brilliant it can work?
Yeah, I mean, I remember as a kid seeing like Sid and Nancy and then listening to the soundtrack. Definitely means Scorsese, you know, the in Goodfellas and the way he uses music to contrast what you're seeing.
Mm.
I mean, that, you know, made such a big impact on me and most filmmakers, you know. But I think there's definitely movies that, of course, Purple Rain. Take Me With You, and I'm instantly in my head on, you know, on the Prince's motorcycle. So I've always loved music and going to bands growing up. Mm-hmm. And for me, making my first short film was like, oh, I get to combine, you know, music and photography and all these things that I love. And that's always a fun part in the edit when you get a song on. And when Phoenix sent the song for the end credits, the new song that they did, Identical, we put it on and it was like, yes, like it, you get a new song and it fits perfectly for the feeling of that moment. And so it's what we always try to edit without it working without music, because music always makes it better. So try not to lean on that too much and add it as a frosting at the end.
Yeah. Think about the composing world and how, you know, working with your husband and Phoenix on over a number of projects and that historical nature of of bands and musicians working on score and soundtracks. And I think of Harold and Maude as being one that I love with Cat Stevens, and just how brilliant, you know, a musical artist captures the essence of a film and creates something that just marries beautifully with it.
Yeah, that one, that's a great one. And The Graduate, I think, was great. We watched that recently with our kids over the confinement break. But yeah, Harold and Maude, it's so much, the music plays such a big part. No, I love that. And it's really an exciting part to have that layer.
Have you always worked like that, where you haven't had music in the edit, so to speak? Is that something you learned?
I learned that maybe talking to Richard Beggs, our great sound designer, who I learned so much from, and just talking about how much the music helps the scene. And so if you can get it to work without that, then it just adds more. And I think maybe people, you know, less experienced kind of rely on to put music on because it always makes it work better. So I don't know, when after making a few films, realizing that it's it does help. So to try to do it without and have to really get the scene to work on the other aspects of it.
Yeah. When you introduce Felix to us on screen in this film, there's a piece of music, an instrumental piece of music.
I think it's the Michael Nyman.
Is it the Michael Nyman one?
Yeah. I think it's like the end of her kind of monotonous routine, and then Felix shows up and makes a grand entrance, and I wanted him to make a big entrance in it with the window lowering and revealing, there he is. But it was meant to be tied into her kind of her rut, and then he shows up like a breath of fresh air.
Because the way that these characters, you know, it's a father-daughter relationship, but it's got this beautiful kind of, I don't know, it's a real journey of their relationship, as well as, you know, her relationship with her husband, and also her role, her relationship with herself, really, as well. Yeah. And I kind of love watching Rashida kind of really take us on that journey as well. And if going back to what I said at the start, is that I kind of feel like that hasn't been done so honestly, really. And even, you know, that comedic side of it as well, where there's those scenes where she's at school and the mum's just talking in her face. And it's just like, I was falling off my chair laughing and it's kind of like, you're trying not to be rude and going, yeah, yeah.
I love her reaction. And when we were filming those scenes, I just would have Jenny keep doing them because they were just so fun to watch. I would give her like some line of things I'd really overheard and she would just go off. But it was funny, and it makes me glad that it's relatable.
Yeah, totally.
But, yeah, Rashida is so good at just with the look, like you know exactly how she feels. And I feel like she sort of kind of gets reconnected with herself, hopefully, yeah, by the end of the story.
Do you encourage improvisation on set? Is that something you like to work with?
I always like that. I never plan everything too much. Like I can't understand storyboarding a whole movie before, because it's, to me, it's like having a party. You get all the elements together and then you see what happens, and you never know, you know, where the actor will end up sitting, or, you know, so that's the kind of the fun of it, that energy of figuring it out together.
Do you know what's next?
I'm starting to, there's a Edith Wharton book that I love, The Custom of the Country, that I've always loved, and I'm starting to think about how adapting that.
Oh, wicked.
So, yeah, I'm excited because I've always loved it. And it was written in 5 parts in serial form, so I thought it would lend itself to doing it in segments. So
yeah,
which you could never fit it into a film, so now it's fun that there's a medium that you can do it in, you know, TV.
Will that be the first time you've taken a step into that world then? It's so different now, because, you know, I guess like years gone by, TV, not that it had a stigma attached to it, but it was kind of like, you know,
yeah, it wasn't
film was this kind of big thing. But I think, you know, when you look at the incredible productions that we see you know, in dramatized form or in episodic form, it's just gives characters an opportunity for, you know, directors and storytellers to expand on characters and give them more time. And
that's what I'm excited about. And I think it lends itself, especially to books that in film form get cut down. Now you see that they're being expanded more. And so, yeah, I mean, in my head, I just think of it as a long movie. I don't really think of it as a different format, but it does have a different aspect, which I think what I enjoy about episodes is where you can't wait for the next one and what's going to happen. So that part is kind of fun to think about, that aspect. And also just, I think in these days to go back to another era and kind of escape into the Gilded Age and a beautiful world, I think is welcome. Or for me, it is at least.
Yeah, we all need escape right now, for sure.
Yeah.
I rewatched Lost in Translation the other night as well. And oh man, I went to Japan for work about, my God, it's 20 years ago now. I did a travel show out there, and it was just, oh, after watching the film as well, I went and got all my pictures out, and it was just I miss traveling. I miss kind of, you know.
Me too. I feel like, we have to do it through movies right now, but yeah, me too. I know my kids were like, when are we going back to Tokyo? I was like, I don't know. I hope not too far off, but I'm glad that you could bring you back there.
Yeah, it was lovely. Listen, it's so great to chat to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time. It's really brilliant. Congratulations on the film again. And we'll get to speak about the next one, I hope.
Thank you. Yeah, I look forward to it.
Take care, Sophia. Thank you so much. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
From the soundtrack to Lost in Translation, that's Ikebana by Kevin Shields, concluding this first part of Soundtracking with Sophia Coppola. On the Rocks, as I said, is available through Apple TV and is by turns honest, moving and very, very funny, which is something we all need right now. I'd also like to point out that Sofia Coppola was my latest guest on my BBC4 TV show, Life Cinematic, where she goes back and picks an incredible collection of films that have been an influence and inspiration to her over the years. There is a fantastic collection up there for you to maybe go and dive into if you like what you see. But please do go and have a look at the show if you missed it. It is up on the iPlayer, Life Cinematic with Sofia Coppola. And so to Alison Brie and her episode of the Disney Plus documentary series Marvel 616. As I mentioned, Alison has had major roles in Community, Glow and Mad Men, among many, many other things, which gives us the perfect excuse to play that iconic theme. I defy you not to picture the visuals. Listen, thank you so much for your time. It's really great to chat to you. I'm such a fan.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you for having me.
I want to obviously chat about this fantastic, I mean, it's quite hard to describe what it is. I've only seen your episode of this Marvel 616. Tell me a little bit about how you were approached to direct this and what it was kind of sold to you as, I guess.
Sure. Well, I'm so excited for you to see more of the episodes because they are all so different. I've seen two other episodes other than my own, Gillian Jacobs's episode and Paul Scheer's. But I guess the way I came into being a part of the series was I received a text message from my friend Brian McGinn, who is a producer at Supper Club, our producers, and the text just said, "Did you do high school theater?" And I texted him back, "Have you met me?" And he was like, "I want to call you and talk about a project." The episode of Glow that I directed in season 3 had just come out on Netflix. And again, Brian's a friend of mine, and I know Jason Sturman as well from Supper Club. And I'm sure since directing my Glow episode, I've been very vocal about wanting to direct more. I had such a great time doing that. And so then I got on the phone with Brian and Jason, and they were already sort of midway through in terms of making the series. I think they had done a few episodes were like fully completed. Yeah. And they just told me, yeah, we're making this anthology series. It's an anthology documentary series for Marvel, for Disney Plus. And it's really about taking this idea of Marvel being the world outside your window and seeing how normal people interact with Marvel, what their relationships are to Marvel, discovering all these different facets of Marvel. Each episode is going to be completely different from the last. They're all directed by different people and with very different styles. And so they basically were like, if you have a connection to this idea, we would be very helpful and supportive in terms of helping you put a team together, as they've produced a ton of documentary stuff. And so then it became more about me facing my own anxieties and kind of, you know, even on that call, I was like, "You guys know I've never done a documentary before," right? But for my episode, you know, some people like Gillian Jacobs, she directed the first episode of the series. And as far as I know, they really came to her with like, kind of, what would you want to explore? And so she had to go about assembling her episode in a very different way. So for me, it really came as a package, which was, we're going to do an episode about the Marvel Spotlight program. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what's the Marvel Spotlight program? And it's a series of one-act plays that were commissioned by Marvel. Marvel sought this out and started this program where they had these three one-acts written about characters in the known Marvel universe when they're in high school to be performed at high schools by high school students. And my knee-jerk reaction, honestly, was one of sort of like, I'm such a... You know, I have such a deep connection to my high school theater experience and my college theater experience. And even though I don't think people associate me with theater because I really haven't done a lot of professional theater since graduating college, but you know, I used to be a bit of a theater snob. And so, you know, at first I was like, they're teaching high school students Marvel plays and not Shakespeare? What is this? How do I feel about this? And then I did some research into the project. I said, Leah, let me think about it. And let me do some, it would interest me to do a series about high school theater students because that is very close to my heart. And I couldn't relate more. And I was really excited actually to dive into the documentary world just in terms of where I'm at in my life as an artist trying to take more risks. I loved directing the episode of Glow. It was so fulfilling. And I just thought, you're not going to know if you can do it until you try it.
Yeah.
So there are all these things that were compelling to me. I'm sorry. I know you asked me like a half a second question and then I talked for half an hour.
This is a dream. This is perfect. Please don't apologize at all. It's great.
But I feel like I just want to finish my thought about the Marvel Spotlight program. Once I started doing research on it, and they, you know, Marvel had even sort of pre-vetted schools and chosen the school. So I really was kind of getting this package and then getting to run with it from there. And getting to meet Courtney Kyle first over the phone and talk to her about why she wanted to do Marvel plays with her students and reading the plays. And first of all, seeing how interesting and nuanced the plays were. I mean, Squirrel Girl goes to college, has a Greek chorus, you know, so it's still employing all of these things that you might want high school students to learn about the machinations of theater and, you know what I mean, things like that. But I was most impressed by the reason that Courtney Kyle wanted to do these Marvel plays with her students was simply to get more students involved in the theater program. And it really worked. Of course, it makes sense that high school students who watch all the Marvel movies, it couldn't be a bigger part of pop culture and the zeitgeist and a part of their lives, whether they read the actual comics or not, were so excited to get to do these plays and play these characters. And then you have this reach where a student like Jamal, who we follow in the episode, you know, just would never have thought about doing theater in high school. And it's so valuable. I really think, and as you see in the episode, that there's just so much that kids can get out of that process of doing high school theater beyond aspirations of being a professional actor. So that's how I got involved.
I had no idea about the program either. And I was kind of like, wow, this is amazing. Because like you say, it encourages them to take that step in the door. But then once they get in the door, it's so emotional and beautiful to see what they all take away from it and the confidence it gives them. And I've forgotten the name of the girl when she kind of goes, you know, she's talking about the role that she's given. She's going, you know, she's curvy. She's got red hair. She's got freckles. And it's kind of the brilliant way that Marvel have written these characters within these plays is kind of as real. They've obviously done a lot of work in terms of making sure that they really represent, you know, the kind of teenagers of today in those situations today.
Absolutely. That was the next wonderful surprise to me, was meeting these characters for the first time, because I don't have this wide expanse of Marvel knowledge and I really wasn't familiar with Kamala Khan, Ms. Marvel, or Squirrel Girl, Doreen Green, both just such fun characters to begin with. Squirrel Girl, you're like, Squirrel Girl, it's just a girl. She's got squirrel powers. It's so simple, but kind of so brilliant.
Yeah.
The characters themselves are fantastic. And then getting to see the way that those characters resonated with the students was so incredibly special and moving and profound. And the lessons that they were learning through these characters are lessons that I continue to need to learn throughout my life. Lessons of positivity, body positivity, self-confidence, you know, not caring what other people think about you, empowering yourself. It's all there.
Yeah. Did you find the whole process really helpful in terms of these brilliant steps that you're taking as an artist into directing? And the idea that you're taking a step in to a theatre group to direct a documentary about a theatre group doing a production. It's kind of almost like a kind of production within a production type thing. But did you take much away from it in terms of adding to your skills as a director?
Oh, definitely. Especially because this type of verite documentary filmmaking is so far from what I'm used to doing in terms of working in film and television, and then directing an episode of episodic television did not feel very far from acting in an episode. You know, I've acted in over 100 episodes of shows over the course of my career. So like moving into the director's seat on a television set just felt seamless. You know, yeah. I mean, obviously that came with its own set of nerves and insecurities, but like, but at least I knew the construct and the bones of what the thing was. And so I guess the safety net in that here was that it was high school theater. So I was going, okay, well, this I know. I can relate to it. I was nervous, I guess, to see, been a minute since I was in high school. Will the kids today, are the things that they're struggling with even similar to what I was struggling with? Mm. Or is it all going to be about social media and their phones? And like, certainly that, I think, is a part of everything that kids today are going through. But one, now I'm like sidetracking, but I found it interesting that the things that they were learning from the characters were so universal, and that just kept getting reinforced over and over and over again. But yes, so, okay. So the construct of theater, being in a safe, it was like being in a safe environment of high school theater helped me to take the risk to do this type of a thing, where then I got there and day one of shooting, I just was like, so there's no plan. I mean, we had a plan, but it was just kind of like, how can you plan? We got to just see what they're going to do. At least we had the framework of the plays that, yeah, that they are doing. So there's a definite process. We know we're going to film their auditions, their rehearsals, you know, opening night, the performance, and somewhere along the way, find a story and just hope that the students really connect to the characters and hope that they're interesting. And then what we found was obviously that there was like so much story. We could have made multiple episodes yeah, about the students at this high school. There's so much we cut out of the episode. So I guess I learned a lot about embracing that fear and taking those risks and really being in the moment.
Yeah.
That the first lesson was about that, kind of just truly just be aware. Just like, it was like this, such a heightened awareness on every level of what's that person doing over there? Should we get, what's the camera guy? Also trust yeah, in my crew. Had a great DP, Wolfgang Held, who would just be creeping all around with the camera and the students, you know, while they're, and we're like, just ignore that super tall German guy. Is he German? Probably not. That we gotta, but you know, it was like, so there was that aspect of trusting him, and also my producer, Claire DeGress, who was, after the first week that we came out there, most of the trips, she was the one conducting the interviews with the students, you know, as we went on, and, you know, being able to lean on her was kind of great and have our communication. So there was really collaborative in terms of where's the story going? Who are we interested in following? What's happening? And then there was like yet another lesson. Every step of it really had all of these lessons of like, during the edit process, that was a whole other thing, and especially because we were doing it during COVID, it was different than the usual experience you would have, like being able to go sit in an edit bay with your editor. It was more like a long game of telephone, like a very layered process. But but it was nice to realize that I had maintained, I don't know, some distance and perspective and objectivity, even in getting to know the students, but kind of being able to take a step back and craft the story mostly in the edit.
You very much felt like you were there with them. You've really taken us into their world so brilliantly, I think, with it. It really is.
Thank you. I mean, well, it's a testament to the students, really, for being, they were so incredibly mature and open and honest and vulnerable. Like, it's interesting. I just don't know if I would have been that way when I was in high school. I think if there was somebody with a camera, I would have been, you know, it's like my instinct would really be to perform for them. And these young adults were just so chill, and they really let everyone in. And I think that speaks to Claire too, my producer. Everyone, the kids felt really comfortable with her, and it was nice for her to conduct the interviews and for them to build those relationships and that trust with her. And then I, like a spy, watching all the footage and like at telling her some other questions to ask, you know.
One of the things that is kind of, you know, part of the Marvel world is these fantastic sort of soundscapes as well that they have, you know, these big themes that you have Alan Silvestri write, or, you know, Ludwig Göransson for Black Panther and stuff like that. When it came to kind of music on the show, and how you wanted to kind of construct that, and how much of the kind of, you know, the big sound and themes of the Marvel world is synonymous with, was that an easy thing to kind of navigate for you in terms of how it would, you know, the music, if there would be music in it, and where it would be and what you would use?
It's an interesting question. The musical aspect was a really interesting part of the process because it's so far outside of my wheelhouse. And I love that you mentioned Ludwig Göransson, because I've known Ludwig for years, since our days on Community, because he did a lot of work,
with
Glover.
Yeah.
And he worked on Community. So it's like so surreal to watch Ludwig, like, is winning an Oscar, and we're like, it's Ludwig. Like, he's so talented, obviously. But I think, and even with this, there was a funny aspect of like not knowing whether or not that was my responsibility, you know, on Glow. In episodic television, it's not. Like, I would put in temp music for my episode, and then they would just redo it and put in their own music later. So, you know, this was really fun. Stephanie Economo. Mm-hmm. I just know I'm mispronouncing her last name because I've like only seen it in email form, even though meet over Zoom. Stephanie did the score.
Yeah.
And she was incredibly collaborative, and it was great. I got to listen to a lot of her music. You know, Supper Club had sent me a bunch of her stuff as a recommendation. And I listened to it, and I agree that I was like, oh, wow, she's really capable of capturing the scope and scale of Marvel, and then also doing stuff that's really nuanced and emotional. And that's what we're dealing with these kids, because I think especially too in the way that Wolfgang shot it, and when we talked about how he was going to shoot it, and really getting behind the kids to see what they're seeing in the huge auditorium. You know, I can remember from my theater experience that even though you might just be in like a small, non-flashy high school auditorium, when you're on the stage, you feel larger than life. You feel like a Marvel superhero, and then you're playing a Marvel superhero. The stakes feel very high. You know, the people in the audience are not strangers. They're your peers. And we wanted to, I think, capture both of those levels, right? These Marvel level stakes of what the kids are going through, and then also the nuances of their friendships and their emotional journeys. And it became like a fun back and forth conversation with Stephanie, who was so collaborative, and like had to, my emails, I feel like we're all like, please forgive my lack of musical knowledge, but the clunkiness here I'm not loving, but then I like how it's like flutter, flutter. You know, at least the good news is I feel like Stephanie always appreciated how meticulous I am, where I'd be like, in the temp track you sent me at 1 minute 22, there's this happens, and that I really like, but you know, I felt like I was communicating with her more on an emotional level.
Yeah.
Then obviously I'm not like, I hear the oboe and could we bring that out? You know, I just don't have that skill. So I'd have to be more like, I love this section of the music, makes me feel this way. And for this next part, I'd like to feel like this.
I know. You're not the only one, don't worry. We've spoken to so many directors. I think even Ron Howard would admit to kind of going, can we have a bit more like the just turn that bit up kind of thing. So yeah.
Well, it's why it's
emotional. It's, like you say, it's, you got to feel it. It's about how it makes you feel.
It's also why it's great that this is a really truly collaborative medium. Like, I can't imagine trying to be like, no, I'm going to do everything. Why? That's so daunting. There's other people that know way more about it than me. Let me pick their brains and let them do what they do and shine. And I think with Stephanie too, it was good to highlight with this score. And I love the score. I think that the story is there, and you're already along for the journey with these kids emotionally. And so it was always also more about just highlighting it and letting it exist. It was not like, I didn't feel like we ever had to manipulate people's emotions with the score. It was sort of like, let's just highlight what they're going through. Yeah.
Listen, before we run out of time, a couple of things I just wanted to quickly talk to you about. You mentioned Community, which I went down a rabbit hole last night, just reminding myself of how great that show was. And there's some really lovely bits actually online of kind of like bloopers, which is such a lovely thing as a fan to watch because you feel like you're on set.
Yeah.
And it just looked like you all had the most fun. The atmosphere on set between you all just felt like so genuine and natural and real friendships.
True. We had the most fun. I've actually spent all morning doing press for this show with Gillian Jacobs, which is so funny because it's totally coincidental that we both have kind of moved into directing and that we both ended up directing on this series. Like there's really no Community connection. And yet, I mean, even for me coming into the series, knowing that Gillian had directed an episode, I was like, oh, great. Like, oh, good. My friend did one. Yeah, that sounds cool. I could, maybe I could do it. I'm going to text her to see if she liked it. We really are so close, our Community cast. We text every day on our Community text chain.
Wow.
And that's such a sweet takeaway. It's very true. I think that's like the most honest thing when you see our bloopers, because we were all like, we worked very long hours and we were maybe losing our minds a little bit sometimes, but yeah. Going a little crazy, but like with family, got to play with each other the way that we played when we were kids, you know?
And Glow, I know that Mark's got his petition on the go for someone to, I've signed it. I want
great,
more.
Great.
Yeah,
me too.
Totally. Yeah, it's but that show, and you know, you, obviously The Warrior is that track that you kind of think, yeah, here we go, we're in that world straight away. Some point we're able to, you know, see Ruth and the gang return in some way, shape, or form.
Thank you.
I really
Thank
hope so.
You for saying that. I would love that. I mean, we did three great seasons of a show that it certainly had a profound impact on me and my life. And it's very touching to know that other people were moved by the show and connected with the characters. So it's been really touching, to see the way that fans have reacted to the news that we're not going to get to do our fourth and final season, but I'm so proud of the work we already made. So thank you for saying that.
Alison, it's so great to chat to you. And I'm really I'm excited to see where you kind of go next in the world of directing, as well as, you know, writing as well, which I know is something, you know, that you do. You've written a rom-com in lockdown, which I'm looking forward to seeing. Maybe you can direct that as well, hopefully.
Well, my husband is directing it. It's already been agreed.
Come on. So,
that's what we'll let him. We'll let him.
Listen, congratulations on your episode for this wonderful series, which I think is just, it feels like the right thing for people to be watching right now as well. You know, we all need some really fantastic celebration of great people. And so I think that's what the show does. So.
Thank you so much. And I couldn't agree more. I think that really what we need right now is human connection.
Absolutely.
And, you know, making this episode, I think the thing I really realized was how Marvel is actually this beautiful connective tissue between so many people in the world who love it, you know? And if I just would love if people could take that away from this series. It's kind of like, oh, wow, there are all different kinds of people all over the world, and we all love the same thing.
It's almost like, I think there's one of the kids in the show says, you know, I never really fit in. I'm not kind of, I'm different to everyone else. And I think that's what Marvel does, is it celebrates the misfits and it gives the misfits a voice. And this kind of takes that step further. So, yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Alison.
Definitely. Thank you,
Eve. Take care. Stay safe. Thank you. Bye, guys.
Like a raindrop, she's got the look. Heavenly bomb, cause heaven's got a number when she's spinning me around. Kissing is a color, a loving is a wild dog. She's got the look. She's got the look.
She's got the look.
She's got the look.
She's got the look.
What in the world can make a brown eyed girl turn blue? When everything I'll ever do, I do for you.
Ah, just one of the many anthemic pop classics to feature in Glow. That's The Look. What a tune by Roxette, rounding off the second part of Soundtrackin' with Alison Brie. And that should be all the encouragement you need to go and check out our Soundtrackin' playlist for this episode up on Spotify, because you can hear that in its entirety. And my huge thanks to Alison and Sophia for joining me. A reminder that Marvel 616 is available via Disney Plus, and On the Rocks is streaming on Apple TV. Head to edithbowman.com to catch up with all of our previous episodes, including my first chat with Sophia and two conversations with Ludvig Göransson. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. Make sure you find our YouTube channel as well for a regular show I put together to accompany this pod. In fact, I'll stick up a little excerpt with Alison and Sophia for you guys to check out. So please do go and seek that out. Thank you in advance for listening. Next week, we've got another double whammy, just because we are inundated with fabulous guests. So I want to share them with you. First up, we have Alan Ball, who is a writer-director. He's written things like American Beauty, and his latest project is the beautiful film Uncle Frank that he has written and directed, and it stars Paul Bettany. It is a fantastic and beautiful little film. Alan Ball will also be joined by a gentleman who has just directed his first feature film, but he's also written it, produced it, as I said, directed it, starred in it, and he's composed the score. The one and only Viggo Mortensen. Viggo Mortensen, Alan Ball, next week's guest on Soundtracking. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then. In the meantime, please stay safe.